This is Cecilia Kacik, the former state senator who represented Greene County. You are listening to WGXC Acra, 90.7 FM and WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-I's into here's how you can's. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com. Or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Oak Pizzeria Napolitana in Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. The Daily Freeman is reporting absentee ballots for the upcoming general election are available now online by mail-in application or in person, but voters who decide to vote absentee can no longer change their minds and vote in person. Authorities have said anyone who has been issued an absentee ballot cannot vote in person on a machine. According to Dutchess County Board of Elections, and I quote, "This is true whether they have submitted their absentee ballot or not. Should a voter desire to vote in person, they must complete an affidavit ballot," end quote. To apply for an absentee ballot, individuals can visit their local Board of Elections until November 7th. Voters can also call or email their local board with questions. Absentee ballots must be postmarked by November 8th, the final day of in-person voting, in order to be counted. The deadline to register to vote is October 14th, and you can read the full story in the Daily Freeman. Rachel Silberstein is reporting for the Times Union. Albany Medical Health System and Columbia Memorial Health Boards announced October 10th. CMH President J.P. Cahalan will retire by the end of the year. He will be succeeded by the hospital's current chief operating officer, Dorothy M. Urschel. Cahalan has led the hospital since 2013. During his tenure, he changed the way CMH delivered care by developing a network of community-based primary and multi-specialty providers in addition to hospital-based services. Officials said during his tenure, he changed the way CMH delivered care by developing a network of community-based primary and multi-specialty providers in addition to hospital-based services. He was instrumental in the acquisition of the Greene Medical Arts Center, which preserved access to specialty care in Catskill, and the addition of physician practices in Turnersville, Coxsackie, Cairo, and Catskill to CMH. He was directly involved in significant additions to the main Hudson campus, including the construction of the Hudson River Bank and Trust Foundation Medical Office Building and the Kneeler Wing. CMH also extended new medical services to Valencia and Copeg during Cahalan's tenure. In 2016, CMH was affiliated with Albany Medical Center. The two hospitals became the first members of what is now the Albany Medical Health System. In 2019, CMH terminated its childbirth services, forcing pregnant women in Greene and Columbia counties to travel to Albany for labor and delivery. Cahalan sat on the Greene County Rural Health Board and will remain a member of the boards and the Bank of Greene County and the Catterskill Commons. Urschel began her career as a critical care nurse and thoracic surgery practitioner at the Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center. She also worked as an acute care cardiac surgery nurse practitioner with Caledia Health in Buffalo. Urschel came to CMH in 2020 as chief operating officer. And you can read the full story in the Times Union. Heather Bellow is reporting for the Berkshire Eagle. Tobacco, seashell, cedar, and pollen are some of the earthly offerings cast into the Housatonic River on October 10th after more than 100 people prayed to them. An Indigenous Peoples Day celebration began at the Great Barrington Town Hall gazebo with singing and speaking before the preparation of the offering ended with a sacred ceremony and meditation at the river. It was a prayer to heal the river, suffering as it has from industrial pollution. Jake Singer, Navajo medicine man, Sundance chief, and activist for Native American veterans, said, and I quote, "The water will know everything that we have been praying about, talking about," end quote. He added, and I quote, "The water is our mother," end quote. They also remembered the slaughter of 24 Narragansett people and the thought of Native American women and girls who are 10 times more likely than anyone else to go missing or be murdered. The gathering came after a third annual weekend of events organized by the Alliance for a Viable Future. The Alliance founder and executive director, Lev Nathan, said a delegation of Stockbridge Muncie Community Band of Mohican Indians and 15 tribal nations came together for the first time. So did the Northeast Indigenous Climate Control Council. For one of the nations, the weekend marked a gradual and recent homecoming after being pushed out of what is now the Berkshires 250 years ago. John Stevens, also Standing Eagle, chair of the Language and Culture Committee for the Stockbridge Muncie Mohican, said, and I quote, "When we were made to leave these lands, we were not appreciated. We were not wanted here. But now when we come back, we find an overwhelming group of people with open arms wanting us back, wanting to know our history, wanting to know our culture, wanting to know what wasn't taught in schools back then," end quote. Read the full story in the Berkshire Eagle. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, and COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Tuesday, October 11th. Local early morning temperatures range from 34 in Ashland to looks like 39 in Catskill. Regional average soil temperature is 52 degrees. The closest possible snowfall today is 1,700 miles away in Wyoming. And keep in mind, if you don't hear me state that number, then I'm not seeing snow anywhere in the country. That doesn't mean it's not cold right here, though. Early morning temperatures are just above freezing for most of the area. Probably safe to assume the higher elevations are seeing frost very early on. A high of 68 happens at 3 p.m. The day ending a lot sunnier than it starts. Overnight temperatures fall to 45 degrees. Then tomorrow we get a high of 70. That comes with some stiff winds and a touch of afternoon wind gusts. 55 degrees overnight takes us into a wet and possibly stormy looking Thursday. A high of 68 is expected. Rain lasts all night, but Friday things dry out and we get a high of 65. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 4:28 a.m., low tide at 10:59 a.m., high tide again at 4:50 p.m., then low tide once again at 11:35 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 59 degrees and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 6:08 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:59 a.m. Looking way up, we see things are calming down with no major plasma streams or CMEs currently expected to visit. Chances are at 45% for M and 5% for X-class solar flares. Solar wind speed is currently 483.9.
Welcome to the Tuesday Afternoon Radio Show with your host, Randall Martin, and today we've got a great show. We caught up with Heather Bruegel. She was one of the organizers of Hudson's first Indigenous Day, which occurred at the park yesterday on Monday. And then we're going to go to Michael Hoffman, who's going to talk to us about his directing of a Chinese opera that's going to be played right here coming up later on this week, I think Thursday. And then we're going to go to Simi Stone in the 5 o'clock hour, a fantastic musician, and catch up with her. She's telling us about all her activities, and she's actually going to be playing in our region on October 17th, Monday, at the Democratic Rally at the Catskill Point. And then we're going to wrap up today's show with Sean Stevens. Sean is the guest speaker, a special guest from Wisconsin, who came to speak for the Hudson's Indigenous Day. But first, let's get right into our interview with Heather. And, you know, yesterday I had a great experience. I was down at the waterfront providing sound for, I believe, our first Hudson Indigenous Day event. And one of the key speakers with me, and I think key organizers, was Heather. And I have her on the line here today. Heather, are you with us?
I am. Thank you so much.
Okay, now did I get it right? Is this Hudson's first Indigenous Day?
To my knowledge, yes. This is the first time that the city of Hudson celebrated Indigenous Peoples Day.
Wonderful, wonderful. And can you tell us exactly kind of what it is and what you organized?
Yeah. So traditionally, the second Monday in October has been recognized as Columbus Day. But we know through history that Columbus was not the best person when it came towards interaction with Indigenous peoples. And so a lot of states, cities, other municipalities have started to embrace, instead of celebrating Columbus Day, celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day instead, really to honor the Indigenous people who were here first and who called this land home. And so I, you know, reached out to the city of Hudson earlier this year, maybe just a couple months ago, and was like, hey, let's do something for Indigenous Peoples Day. And wrote up a little, you know, proposal, and it was accepted. And so there was a proclamation for Indigenous Peoples Day. That was the first. And then we had this event yesterday as well to celebrate Indigenous heritage. And it was really good.
Yes, it was an excellent event. You know, and as you say, as a point of fact, Columbus did not discover America. America was here and it was occupied when he got here. So yesterday was very, very enlightening. And there was, you know, there's a nice crowd. It was such a beautiful day on the riverfront. And and hopefully we're going to get a chance to speak to Sean to talk about some of the comments that he made. But how did you feel? What was that significance of the day for you?
So for me, it was really important that the place that I live in now, Hudson, and you know, others really embrace what Indigenous Peoples Day is. Being, you know, I am Oneida and Mohican, and so my Mohican ancestors are from this land. You know, they lived on this land. So to have it celebrated in places that we have historically called home was really, really amazing. And being able to have our speaker, Sean Stevens, who is a citizen of the Stockbridge Muncie Mohican community, to be able to have him come to the land, be in front of that mighty river that, you know, so many of us, you know, have ancestral ties to, and have him talk about the history of that land and lead us in song and prayer. It was amazing. It was more than what I could have thought it could be.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And you know, I think one of the things that came out of that discussion is that what we call the Hudson River is, and it was a kind of revelation, because what we call the Hudson River is not traditionally called the Hudson River. And actually, when we think of Mohicans as a tribe, that also has other, that name has other meanings, right?
Yeah. So in our ancestry and our language, you know, we call the Hudson River the Mahicanutuck, which is the river that flows both ways. And obviously we know scientifically why it flows both ways. But yeah, so that's the name that, you know, we had called the river. And then the Mohican people also referred to as the Mahicanutuck, which is people of the waters that are never still. So obviously that really coincides with the naming of the river, because the river is never still. And so Mohican people have traditionally settled along rivers. So whether it's here in the Hudson Valley or in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, the water has always been extremely important to us. Even on the reservation today in Wisconsin, there's the beautiful Red River that flows right through it. So it's always been a source of importance. And I think yesterday during the event, we were really able to see, you know, the significance of that, and have it be celebrated once again was just really cool.
Hey, what do you think that people should know about Native American culture that most people don't know?
I think one thing that people should know is that it's a culture that's still around. You know, it's people, sometimes I have encountered people who had no clue that Indigenous people still existed. And I think it's really important to understand that the cultures are still there and they're still thriving. And, you know, we, because of our ancestors who survived, we are able to continue to talk about that culture and that history. And that it's also, I think a lot of times too, people like to put all Indigenous people into one like basket, and we're not all the same, because all cultures are different. And so what we celebrate here in the Northeast is going to be different than what's celebrated and learned about in the Southwest or in the Pacific Northwest or wherever. So we're all different, but we're all vibrant. And we've all got that commonality of resistance and fighting to keep our culture and our languages alive. And I think it's really important that people, you know that, and reach out to different organizations or Native tribes to want to learn more about that culture. That's something we want to share with people. We want people to know about our history and our culture and our teachings. And so all people ever have to do is ask, because we want that to be part of people's everyday learning.
So when people hear the phrase "The Last of the Mohicans" or the book or the movie, that's obviously wrong.
It is obviously wrong, right? And funny story, really quick. I was watching Last of the Mohicans one time because number one, I had never seen the movie, and so I was like, let me watch the movie and let me point out these historical inaccuracies. But what ended up happening is I ended up falling in love with the scenery in the movie, and so I thought that I know, really bad. I was like, oh my god, this is so pretty. But obviously that story is a false narrative as well written as it is. It's a false narrative. You know, I think like we saw last night, and I believe what Sean even reiterated, is we're not the last of the Mohicans. There are Mohican people in the thousands still around. And so I think because there is a book that has gone down in history as an extremely wonderful and well-written novel, it's painted this narrative that Mohicans are no longer in existence, and it's just not true. We're still around, you know, and I think it's important to note, but definitely Last of the Mohicans has definitely played a role in, I would say, some erasure. And so it's really important that people like Sean get the word out and get the and let people know, hey, nope, we're still here. We're still around.
Well, that's an interesting commentary, because you're saying it's a well-written book and a beautiful movie, but just false.
Right. It is. It is. It is. I mean, you know, I love good fantasy and good fiction every now and then. So it's just, it's important to remember that when people watch it, please don't take it as historical accuracies. It's not. It is historically inaccurate in the fact that the title Last of the Mohicans is just, it's just not true.
So, all right, so let me ask this question. All right, in Hudson, we hear a lot about the Dutch, and a lot about, and I think it was the Quakers that early on bought land here. Did you know, and Sean talked about this, and hopefully we'll get a chance to hear a little bit more about the history of how land got to be the way it is and who owns the land. But that's what we hear. You hear about Hudson being, you know, settled by the Dutch, and then I think the Quakers sold it to the Dutch. How did it get that way? How did it come from the hands of the Native Americans into the hands of the colonists?
Yeah, so as Sean did mention yesterday, and as is mentioned in our history, in 1609, Henry Hudson came sailing down the river into the Hudson, what is now the Hudson River Valley area. And he was greeted by the Mohican people. And what happened next was the implementation of the fur trade. And so people in Europe were very obsessed with furs from the animals here in North America. And so what it started was the fur trade, and the economy changed, right? And so what happened is you had different indigenous tribes, so not just the Mohican people, but also others who were in the area as well, just on the other side of the river. And they started trading with the colonists, right, and getting different trade goods. And so as Sean, I believe, did speak to yesterday, is that we became dependent on those different trade goods, because some of them obviously were tools that you would use in everyday life. So whether that was kettles or bakeware or things like that, there were also at some times weapons being traded. So guns and things like that. And we found that they could be super useful. And so it would just snowballed from there. And so there was a sense of dependence that came with colonization and with the fur trade happening, where indigenous people and the colonists kind of became dependent upon each other. And then from there, obviously, history happens, and the Dutch do eventually relinquish control of the area that we call New York, and it goes into the hands of the British. And so it just continues to snowball from there. And when the British take over, there's more of a sense of pushing the indigenous people out of the area. And not like super bad, but bad enough that there was some displacement that happened, but most of the displacement that happened would happen after the American Revolution, when after the colonists won, there were treaties that were then signed, and then there was removal that would happen. And so it's just, it's a snowball effect, and it all started from a changing in the economy, which would have started with the fur trade.
And from the conversation yesterday, from what I understand, is that the Native Americans fought, some of them participated in the war on the side of the colonists against England.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Mohicans were a group that fought on the side of the colonists. I am a citizen of the Oneida Nation, and the Oneida people fought on the side of the colonists, as did the Tuscarora, as did a number of many other groups. So yeah, there was division amongst indigenous tribes as to who was going to fight for who, and there were a number of tribes that did absolutely side with the colonists, yes.
And, you know, and speaking now, we've just gone through a pandemic in our lifetime. But during that time, because of the fur trade, was there a sort of pandemic in the, you know, in the sense that the Native Americans got, you know, smallpox and other communicable diseases that really mm-hmm. impacted the tribes in a great way?
Yeah, absolutely. With contact with the Europeans, disease would ultimately spread rampant through different tribal nations. You would have entire villages being wiped out by diseases that were brought over with colonization happening. I know in Massachusetts, there were a number of Wampanoag villages that would be completely wiped out, and that would just spread throughout the New England and New York areas. And so, yeah, we definitely faced a lot of hardships at the very, very beginning with having to fight these diseases that we'd never came in contact with before. So we didn't have immunity against them. And so they would just wipe out and decimate the communities.
So this was a real, like, when you look at the, you know, the colonists entering, disease happening, trade dependencies also occurring all at the same time, it seemed to be quite a traumatic sort of event for mm-hmm. the Native Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, disease combined with land loss, combined with your way of life being taken away, can definitely cause trauma that can be passed down through generation after generation. And it's something that we can still see the effects of today, you know, especially in our communities where we are trying to bring back some of the old ways or learn the language. You know, there's that struggle that's there because so much has been lost. But what's really great about our indigenous communities is our resiliency and how we continue to fight through no matter what and say, no, we're going to have a place here. We're going to continue to learn and do these ceremonies, or we're going to continue to learn and speak our language and be proud of that. So out of that trauma does come some sort of healing.
Excellent. And what do you, and how do you now continue to pass down this legacy to, you know, to the next generation or to people that are interested in knowing about it?
Yeah. So one of the things that I encourage people to do is to obviously go to tribal websites in order to learn more about that history. But for me personally, you know, the work that I do as a consultant, as a lecturer, really talking about our indigenous histories is one way that I look at as passing along the history that I have learned, or teaching history in a way that maybe people haven't ever thought about before or ever had that experience with before. And so I want people to know who we are and that we are still a resilient people. And then within our communities, you know, and I've done this as well, you know, I go to my elders and I listen when they tell stories and I take that knowledge in, and then I make sure I pass it to, let's say, you know, my brothers and sisters or other people who are curious, you know, passing that down to the next generation. You know, we take that knowledge from the seven generations before us and we keep that knowledge and we pass it down to the next seven generations after us. So it continues to go on, and these stories are continued to being told. So it's really important, you know. Obviously, COVID was very hard on indigenous communities, and we lost a lot of culture bearers and knowledge keepers and language speakers. And so there's more of a push now than ever to get these stories from our elders and those who keep that knowledge and make sure we are passing it down to the next generation.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And, you know, we dive right into the event. And I feel like we don't know enough about you and what led you to push for this event to happen, and about your you know, about your lecturing and your educational activities. So why don't you tell us, our audience, a little bit about you.
Yeah, okay, so I'm an enrolled citizen of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin and a first-line descendant Stockbridge Munsee Mohican. It's been a year this month that I've been in Hudson, and so very much enjoy living here in the Hudson River Valley area. I'm originally from the Midwest. I spent most of my life in Michigan, lived a little bit of time in Wisconsin before moving here. I'm currently a doctoral student at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, in First Nations education. And that is just going to help fuel the work that I do. I work as a decolonial education consultant, where I partner with different organizations mm-hmm. who are looking to decolonize the work that they're doing and create more inclusive spaces and tell more inclusive histories. And so I focus in on the indigenous histories. And then I also lecture. I've lectured at various universities, museums, on federal Indian policy, federal Indian law, and different historical events that happen in our indigenous histories, and help bring awareness to those issues that are happening now, whether it is what's going on with the Indian Child Welfare Act currently, and also talking about the epidemic of missing and murdered indigenous women, and bringing awareness to that. And so I decided that to be proactive in my own community and say, you know what, I live in this community that's the ancestral homelands of my ancestors, and we need to be celebrating the indigenous history here. So I approached the city of Hudson and I said, hey, we need to do something. And so luckily they were very receptive, and celebrated Indigenous Peoples Day yesterday, and I will be curating some programming for the city of Hudson for November next month, which is Native American Heritage Month. So we will be learning more about indigenous history, and we'll definitely send out more information when I have it.
Now, you said a very interesting term that I had never heard. Decolonization. Thank you. And it seems like such a big and important topic. How do you set upon doing that? How do you get people's minds in to see this different perspective?
Yeah, so it's hard. It's hard, and it can be exhausting. But it's really about creating those inclusive spaces for stories that are not often told. And the stories that aren't often told are those from communities that have been ignored throughout history, and one of them is the indigenous community. You know, we always hear about, the encounter with indigenous peoples when, you know, the colonists first come over, and then it seems that history is kind of sugar-coated. And in order to create these spaces where that history is being told, we have to get rid of that colonial way of thinking. We have to decolonize. We have to take that out and indigenize instead. And So that's just creating space for indigenous histories and indigenous peoples. And the work can be really hard and really exhausting. And there are some days where I'm just like, I'm done. I'm too tired. I can't do this anymore. And then I think about the work that, you know, has been done before me. And I think about what my ancestors survived so that I could be here to do mm-hmm. this work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just get a good night's sleep, and I wake up in the morning and I do it all over again.
Wow. Wow. It seems like a big task, but it seems like you're completely up to the task.
I am up to the task. Some days I wonder why, though, but I'm definitely up to it. Yeah.
Well, you know, yesterday was just such a wonderful and powerful program. And I think that people were just enthralled with the history and with the, I think the concept, and I think it went a way of, like you said, presenting another point of view that people didn't have. What do you think about, like, what are your feelings now? We're coming up on soon, not this month, but next month, we're coming up on Thanksgiving. Thoughts for that? Now that sort of Columbus Day is being framed a little bit more accurately or more accurately, what are your thoughts on that holiday?
Well, I have actually not celebrated Thanksgiving in a number of years, and the reason why I don't is because it's not really a holiday that I think encompasses what people think it does. You know, there's this false narrative around it about, you know, the pilgrims and the Indians and getting along. And really what happened, you know, beforehand, there were massacres and there was heartache and there was a loss of land and culture. And so it's just, it's not really a day that, that I, you know, want to celebrate in that way. So there is something called the National Day of Mourning, and that falls on Thanksgiving every